Same to you.
The on Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order. This is our first meeting of the 2009 session, and I'd like to welcome everybody back. We don't have any new members, and I don't think we have any new staff people, but I thought that I would just reintroduce staff to members so that you can try to remember who's who. Senate counsel is Chris Stang. Darlene, is it correct if I say Sliwa?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Is our legislative analyst. Sandra Boone, back over here in the corner, is with Senate Majority Research. Linnea, is it Michelson? Back in the corner with Republican Caucus. Tangi Harrison is our committee administrator. Jamie Olson is legislative assistant. Is there anybody that...
introduce this guy here.
I'm Dan Sparks' neighbor.
You're not that good looking.
And Bennett Hartz over here is interning in my office. I don't know if anybody else... Pardon me? Oh, B. There she... You know, you were here a minute ago. I'm sorry. B. Ludens is our committee page again. So... with that, not a real long agenda. Pardon me? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I see you got smart. You didn't give me a microphone today.
I heard you just fine, though, Senator Marty. That wasn't. Did we do that on purpose?
Do this, you got it.
Anyway, so as I said, I want to welcome everybody back. This year, I've told others outside of the legislature that I thought policy committees could be just submerged with business because with no money to spend, with the appropriations or spending finance committees, debating cuts and slashes and burns and the tax committee trying to find a way to raise taxes without raising taxes or to raise revenue without raising taxes.
Good trick.
Yeah, that policy committees would probably have more than their share of legislation to consider. I don't know that for sure, but it just seems to me that that might happen. And we'll have some real serious issues before us. We're not meeting next Tuesday, I think that's right. But we are going to meet a week from today, and it's going to be a joint meeting down in Room 15 with the Transportation Committee. And we're going to be talking about not all regulation, but how regulation, some regulation, has an impact on the cost of driving or owning and operating an automobile in Minnesota. And it will touch on some insurance questions, but it will also, touch on other aspects of the cost of that. And because I think there may be some ways, at the end of the day, do we really think we will lower costs for Minnesotans? At the end of the legislative session, do you think that costs will be lower? I think there is some room there in terms of automobiles where we might be able to save our constituents some money. So that's going to be something that we're going to just start doing. It's just going to be informational in a sense, but I think it'll be really interesting. I think you'll find, what we have to share very interesting. So if anybody has any comments they'd like to make, welcome Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you.
We'll get started, and some of the members may know that insurance fraud is an issue that has concerned me considerably in the course of serving on this committee, and I think everybody has a letter dated 1997, so 12 years ago almost, exactly 12 years ago, then Attorney General Hubert Humphrey had something to say about insurance fraud. I'm assuming that the cost of insurance fraud may have gone up over that time. I don't know, but it was an issue then, and it continues to be. But we do have, we are doing something proactively about that. And so that's what Commissioner Wilson and the gentleman with him, Mr. Hansen and Mr. Carillis, are going to talk to us about. And I would say welcome, gentlemen.
Thank
you,
Madam Chair.
Good to see you again. And Commissioner, did you want to speak first? And
Yes, thank you very much. After 7 years, starting my seventh year, I'm still nervous to come before a committee, but I very much appreciate the past 6 years, the cooperation, support, and the ability to work very closely with the committee. It's very much appreciated, and I think it's been beneficial for our state and our government. In the past, we've come before your committee and talked to you about the way we're organized and what we do and some of the things in a general way. Today, we'd like to talk more specifically about the anatomy of the way we do an investigation. From the beginning of the administration, we've developed over some time a very different attitude, frankly, toward the and to address what you speak of. More specifically, we had civil responsibility in the past, but it wasn't very long until it became pretty clear that a lot of the abuse was criminal in its form. And so we have taken steps over the past few years to develop a fraud unit, and I'm proud today to present to you the where we are with the fraud investigation and the way we conduct business today. We find consistently there's been an increase in the number of what we call crimes. It's not just a civil offense. It's a criminal offense. The number of these frauds has increased. The number of people involved in it, the number of victims involved has significantly increased. Secondly, and probably just as important, the number of cases that we are handling, we're handling with an eye toward criminal prosecution. And this increases the amount of work for the department because white-collar crime is not typically easily presented in a form to get prosecuted. So when we look back over the history of the department, we were referring or working with the people to pursue a criminal activity maybe 2 to 5 times a year. That is significantly, it's now significantly higher, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But there's no question that it takes cooperation in the department all the way from the consumer response team to the insurance and real estate team to the fraud unit. And in many ways, it is very much sophisticated. So I have just a few statistics to put it in perspective prior to my turning over to the real experts. But the fraud unit, 28 investigations involving prosecution of 40 defendants and 138 victims. Real estate team, 22 investigations, 139 defendants, and 1,600 fraudulent transactions. The insurance team, 20 investigations. That's for 08. That is significantly, as I mentioned, it used to be 2 to 5 a year. And now we're looking at several hundred a year and a lot of people involved. The department is uniquely organized, I'd like to take credit for the department and this committee's support in the improvement in the fraud unit's investigations. But the truth is, I want to make sure that the committee understands the wisdom of this committee historically, because we lead the nation in collection company fraud investigations. We lead the nation in real estate fraud investigations. And a number of others. And the reason partly is that we are organized differently than almost any other state in the nation. In the two disciplines that I like to single out is in the area of finance. We have insurance, we have banking and securities all in one. In today's environment, a fraud on the financial area very often covers different disciplines. That's particularly true in the real estate area. Most states have a separate board for realtors, another board for mortgage, another board for appraisers. In our state, we have the insurance, the mortgage insurance, the title insurance, the realtors, the mortgage people, the appraisers, and we even have the responsibility for the notaries for the discipline. So when it's hard to perpetrate, you're a realtor, it's hard to perpetrate a real estate crime without involvement of other people. And so when I say that these cases are very complex and very complicated, I think that you'll see that readily. But the fact that we have all the disciplines in our shop makes it significantly better for Minnesotans for us to be able to see the nature of the crime across the board. It also, when we take a case, a white-collar case, to a prosecutor or to another, we work with a lot of other agencies. When we take a case to them, they know now that our department has the expertise to put together a white-collar crime portfolio that is prosecutorial. And secondly, we provide the expert testimony and support to the other investigators that we work with, the other agencies. And when it gets to prosecution, we give them the support they need to win. I mean, most white-collar crime, or not most, some of it is not prosecuted because they don't have the complete file or they don't have expert testimony that they can count on. But we've had good success in the courts, and that is helping to build our reputation to get successful cases seen. So with that, I would like to turn it over first to George Curlis, who's come to the a year ago to the department with 27 years of experience with the FBI, taking over and building that into a real team and coordinating it now with the other areas of the department. So, George, why don't you take over?
Mr. Curlis, welcome again.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, and good afternoon. It is my pleasure to meet with you today, and what I'd like to do today is give you an overview of what happens when the Insurance Fraud Division receives information about a crime involving a complex crime such as healthcare fraud.
Can you say your name for the tape for us, just so?
George Carillas.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to let you know how we receive information about a insurance fraud crime. Our division receives complaints and referrals from three different sources. The first sector identified as the government sector includes other law enforcement agencies, state agencies, and prosecutorial offices. Secondly, we receive complaints from the private sector, which includes the National Insurance Crime Bureau and the special investigation units of insurance companies. And thirdly, the public sector, which is the consumer. We receive our complaints in a number of different formats, primarily through our website, through our email addresses, through our telephone hotline, facsimile, letter, in-person, and suspected fraud crime reports from the insurance companies. Our division has access to several databases, which we use in our investigative analysis. These databases provide us information regarding insurance claims, agent broker licensing, workers' compensation claims, unemployment insurance, criminal records, registration and ownership of businesses, and background information on the individuals that we are investigating. We also have access to a number of investigative tools. We utilize these tools that are provided by the complainant, and in a number of cases, there are going to be investigative reports from insurance companies, claim analysis that's done on the claims filed by the individuals that are being investigated, depositions that were made, medical and billing records, police records, and surveillance records and photographs are also things that are provided to us. Our investigators and our analysts have a number of different investigative techniques that can be used during the course of investigation, all depending on the complexity of the case and the complexity of the fraud. Some investigators may require only a number of techniques, and others may involve several techniques before enough evidence can be gathered to present the case for prosecution. Some of these techniques include reviewing documents for evidence of crime, investigative analysis of those documents, obtaining witness statements and statements from suspects, conducting surveillance, contacting confidential sources, subpoenaing bank records and other financial records, conducting search warrants, conducting computer forensics, and undercover operations. I'd like to provide an overview of how one of our investigators conducted a criminal investigation on an organized enterprise acting as a healthcare provider in Minnesota. The healthcare provider was a chiropractor who came to Minnesota and had trouble finding patients for his new clinic. Initially, to drum up business, he hired runners to go out and find new patients for him. The runners targeted the immigrant communities and offered $100 to anybody who would come to the clinic for services by the chiropractor. The runner had already staged an accident in a parking lot and coached the new patients on how to claim fake injuries in the accident. The patients went to the clinic, signed in multiple visits, and received $100 in cash for their visit. Thereafter, the clinic altered billing records that they sent to the insurance companies and to workers' compensation. The clinic provided the patients with little, if any, treatment. The clinic submitted claims for each patient just shy of the $20,000 threshold for no-fault benefits. We started our investigation on this particular doctor when we received allegations of fraud from the Department of Labor and Industry. After we received the information, we conducted surveillances on the clinic, and we were able to identify the employees and the number of patients that were visiting the clinic, and the fact that this doctor also had a second chiropractic clinic. We also reviewed databases that we had available to ourselves to confirm the ownership of the clinic, the medical licenses, and identify the insurance claims that were submitted by the clinic to the insurance companies. Further analysis of the insurance and workers' compensation claims confirmed our allegations that this individual was committing insurance fraud. Furthermore, we conducted interviews on some of the former employees and other patients that had visited the clinic, and it confirmed that that the clinic was providing excess treatment, was double billing the insurance companies, and was charging for services not rendered. Many times, this particular chiropractor billed for services when he was on vacation. The depositions that this chiropractor provided in litigation, he admitted that he was overbilling the insurance companies. Afterwards, we conducted additional surveillances and identified additional business associates and the location of his third billing service company. Our databases confirmed the vehicle registration, the ownership of the residences and the businesses. And thereafter, we were able to conduct, obtain search warrants and executed search warrants on several locations in the Twin Cities area. We received numerous boxes of evidence and computer documents or computers. We had our computer examiner conduct a forensic examination of those computers and found a plethora of evidence indicating that this individual was committing fraud. The review and the analysis of the seized documents took quite a long time. We seized over 100 boxes of documents on these searches, and those and evidence was obtained on those reviews indicating that this individual indeed was committing insurance fraud. We prepared an investigative report, and that report was provided to the county attorney's office for prosecution, and at this point, that's where the case is sitting. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding the insurance fraud division at this time.
Mr. Grillis, I was going to ask you, did you say how you were alerted to this situation, or maybe you don't? It's not been adjudicated yet, right?
It has not been adjudicated yet, but I did indicate that we did receive information from the Department of Labor and Industry.
I see. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Grillis. Would you say that example you just gave in a given year is a typical example of a widespread problem in the state, or would you say that would be sort of an unusual situation of that level of fraud being committed by a medical professional?
Mr. Grillis.
Thank you. I believe that it is a widespread problem in Minnesota. We have a number of cases where individual chiropractors have come from other states and have set up shop in Minnesota, because it's a lot easier here for them to make money in car accidents and stage accidents than it is in other states.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grillis, could you be a little more specific? How many cases like that do you prosecute in a year where you have a chiropractor that you're prosecuting for that kind of wholesale fraud? Or wide scale, not just an individual case or two, but a kind of a big pattern of fraudulent activity from what you described.
Mr. Grillis.
We have at least a dozen cases open on chiropractors in Minnesota. We probably could have a lot more. We have information that in one particular state when no-fault insurance was going to be rescinded, that chiropractors set up shop in Minnesota and opened up a pretty much a empty office and just started billing insurance companies.
Wow. Senator Van De Veer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any type of breakdown by profession of this type of activity, fraudulent activity?
In the area of healthcare fraud?
Healthcare or generally?
In the area of healthcare fraud, the majority of our cases are in chiropractors.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And
thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to introduce Paul Hansen. Paul's been with the department for 22 years in the investigating area, mostly in insurance. Broadly speaking, insurance covers a lot of activity in the real estate area as well. So Paul has been very helpful in the with Bonnie Polda's group, her team, in bringing together the consolidation of some of these investigations. So, Paul, I'll turn it over to you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you'll just say your name for
Paul,
us.
Paul Hansen. The complaints where our investigations typically come from are a variety of sources that I mentioned last time I was here. We get information from our CRT unit. We get complaints that are written in by consumers. Some of the more significant leads that have led us to some of the fraudulent activities that my investigators have looked into, though, have come from other licensed professionals and licensed entities. George mentioned some of the databases and techniques they use. As a practical matter, my investigators utilize, with few exceptions, many of the same tools and techniques. Some additional databases that we use, one is the NAIC database. It's a national database of information regarding insurance producers, insurance companies, financial information about insurance companies, actions against insurance companies and insurance producers. That's been a valuable resource for us, as well as the FINRA Central Registration Depository, which is the same sort of data, national database regarding securities professionals. We also utilize and get information from the Federal Health and Human Services Department, the FTC, and the U.S. Treasury through FinCEN. We have a number of investigations and exams that are actually multi-state in nature, where we partner with either other state departments of insurance, other securities administrators, things like that. We have my team has focused on the areas of title and mortgage insurance, the suitability and basically misconduct in the area of the sale of financial products, workers' compensation, and I also have several or two investigators that deal with collection agencies, and out of those we've had a number of fraud cases where we have actually taken over the collection agency, put them into receivership, and made claims against bonds or basically bond insurance to try to make whole the businesses and debtors that paid into those collection agencies.
Mr. Hansen, I was going to say, could you tell us what a collection agency kind of case involves? But apparently it's fraud perpetrated against a consumer, but also the business that's hired them to do it?
Yes, I'd hope to get to that later, but I'll get to it now.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
I'll cover it right now since you brought it up, Madam Chair. What's involved with those is we've now had seven that we have taken into receivership. Out of those, we've had one that was just criminally charged, I believe, 2 days ago. One was charged and prosecuted, I believe, a little over a year ago. What happens is a creditor comes to the collection agency, says, I need these debts collected. And in many of these, in all seven of these receiverships, a lot of the creditors that brought accounts to these collection agencies were small, mid-sized Minnesota businesses. And the other nefarious part about it is the debtors that made payments into the collection agency don't get credit for those payments. And I believe just yesterday one of my investigators pointed out that the total out of those seven is in excess of $1 million of money that was collected that was not credited to debtors for having made those payments or given to the creditors that were owed that money by the collection agency. As I mentioned, one of the other areas that I have emphasized on my team is the title insurance and mortgage insurance area. And to kind of make it more personal, I'm from South St. Paul, and every week I get a paper
Senator
out there.
Senator Metzen is very interested.
How you doing? See you again.
I get this weekly paper, and a few years back, you seldom saw foreclosure notices. Now you can go in there, and there's pages and pages of foreclosure notices, and a lot of those, in my opinion, arose out of fraudulent conduct by mortgage brokers, mortgage lenders, and persons within that area, and that's why I believe our emphasis in that area is very important. Another area that we've emphasized is, like I said, the financial product area. But getting to the title and mortgage area, George's unit, mine, Bonnie Polta's, basically covering insurance fraud, insurance, appraisers, mortgage brokers, real estate agents. And I want to clarify, real estate agents, not realtors, because realtors are a designation for certain other designations. But there's a variety of people that get involved. These title companies, title underwriters, closers, notaries are all involved in it. And the example I've got, I'll call Split Rock, and I believe you have a handout. It's called A Hierarchy of Actors. And what it was is a builder bailout scheme is what it's classically called. It involves overappraising a home and then finding what are called straw buyers in the investigative arena that get money from some party to both put the money down and to fund payments until they can get past a certain time period. And that's how the parties overappraise the home so that there's enough value in the transaction so that they can all profit by this conduct. And that conduct actually harms communities, as I've identified. It also freezes up the mortgage marketplace because investors become leery about investing in mortgage-backed securities. So you've got, in a transaction like this, as I mentioned, you've got a variety of people. It took us to serve and execute all the search warrants. It took 2 days. And I believe it covered 8 different locations. And it involved, like I said, a large number of both local law enforcement, George's unit, and a variety of investigators from our department. As you can see from the diagram, it covers both a construction finance company, real estate companies, builders, title companies, closing agents, appraisers, and the straw buyers. They're very complicated. They involve a lot of people, a lot of moving parts, and a lot of documents, and it takes a lot of manpower. But these cases are very large, and they're complicated. I've already gone through all the various people that are involved in these sorts of schemes, and that also goes to how complicated these particular investigations are. I'd also like to give an individual example. We have a person that we have issued a statement of charges against. Her name is Patrice Pouliot. This is public information. She, in our allegations in that statement of charges, she diverted 38 checks totaling $63,000 out of closings over a period of time. And those are and it's my belief that none of the homeowners in those transactions knew their money had been stolen. We also have another case that's currently under investigation that we have not charged yet that involves in excess of $200,000, and the number of people in that we don't believe had any idea that their money was stolen out of the closing. People rely on these people, and once again, they're complicated transactions because in all those loan documents you see at your own loan closing, there's a lot of documents, and it's easy to obscure and hide somebody's theft of your funds. Another area I wanted to cover was unsuitable sales and other misconduct. We just recently concluded an action against Physicians Mutual. It involved a penalty of $375,000. They ceased sales in Minnesota, and prior to their coming back into the state, they'll have to agree to certain adjustments in their policies and procedures, as I'll define it. They're also currently also undergoing a restitution plan where they'll be offering refunds to various consumers. The allegations involve failing to determine suitability for sales involving annuities, long-term care insurance, and med sup insurance. And that is something I'd like to highlight, because while Minnesota has cooperated and participated with a number of other states in establishing a more national regulation regarding suitability of annuities, Minnesota for over 20 years has had a law that requires agents and companies basically to ensure the suitability of both health insurance, life insurance, annuities, long-term care, and med sup insurance. An individual example in the financial sales product is somebody else we've issued a statement of charges on. Her name is Christine Finley, and in there we allege that she basically duped three different couples. That's the number of people we're basing our allegations on, three different couples into switching their Medicare D policies or coverage from one company to another, and that can lead to unpaid claims under where they're not compensated in the same manner. These folks actually thought they, and these are all senior citizens, they all thought they were just getting additional information when it actually been switched to a different company. And in one instance, the person started encountering unpaid claims from the start. In the area of those sorts of investigations, my investigators actually have, in one occasion, one of them rode with a person that the agent wanted to travel to Wisconsin to avoid Minnesota laws so they could use a Wisconsin policy. That person has had been dealt with. We also have had investigators sit at a kitchen table with consumers when somebody is making a sales presentation, basically pretending to be a relative, a family member, something like that. We also sometimes consumers just want us to have let them use a recording device, and they'll record it themselves. And those have provided interesting investigative results for us as well. We recently also have been partnering with some other states and hope to broaden that, but we are with the Federal Health and Human Services Agency. They provide us lists of where seminars are going to occur for the Medicare products that are currently out there, and we're doing just basically drop-in visits, and the plan is to also do mystery shopping visits to make sure that marketplace is properly served by the licensed professionals that are out there. It's my belief that in the vast majority of cases, they are being properly served, but we also want to make sure that those ethically challenged individuals are located and dealt with. In the workers' compensation area, it's an area that we have focused on. That's kind of subsided. Recently, the Minnesota Workers' Comp Insurance Association resolved their litigation with AIG, getting a rather significant settlement. I believe it was $25 million. That was well in excess of what was previously offered through a New York multi-state settlement. Minnesota continues to be a lead state in the AIG multi-state examination because we do believe that there are substantial national issues that need to be resolved with regard to the allegations involving that particular company or group of companies. Right. I've already covered the collection area, so I guess I'm with that, I'll end my testimony.
Well, Mr. Hansen, I was wondering how long have you've been with the department for, 22 years, I think,
yes.
Commissioner said, but have you been able to do all these things? Have you been doing these things all along, or is there an increase? And is there an increase? I've got to believe there's been an increase in capacity to do a more thorough job. I don't know, since we have
capacity for us to do a more thorough job? I probably should leave that to the commissioner. I don't know that I have any more people today than I did a number of years ago.
Okay.
We've just tried to do our best to become more effective. But I would say there was a time when I naively thought if we made good examples out of a couple of, say, insurance agents, that the problem would maybe not be as substantial. Unfortunately, what I found is a variety of insurance companies and other insurance agents, for example, started reporting other agents that were engaged in thefts and defalcations.
Okay. I'm guessing that the piece that Mr. Carrillis brings, that those people are probably helpful. Do you make use of
their expertise? Yes, I have a number of investigations that his people are working with us on or that my investigators are working on with his. We've had some that we've independently brought to either the U.S. Attorney's Office or a county prosecutor, but with them joining the department, we're actually cooperating with them more and more every day. We also have increased our interaction amongst the department over the last several years as well. And quite frankly, the title and mortgage insurance area has just literally been an explosion in our department in terms of the volume of activity that's arisen out of it.
Senator Vandeveer probably finds that particularly interesting. If I recall, you have concerns in that area. So, any questions from?
Sure.
Yes, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Mr. Sausage Paul Hansen, how are you today? You know, you hear of, you didn't, maybe you could give us a deeper briefing on these unscrupulous percentage of mortgage brokers that are, I don't know if they have their brother-in-laws appraising the property, and I don't know who's inspecting them, and I don't know what, you know, if the draws are too much and for the work that has been done. And have you had any prosecution of, and I don't mean to put everybody in that business into that category, but there's a lot of stuff going on out there, or has been going on, and have you prosecuted anybody in that area?
Mr. Which area?
The mortgage fraud, I guess. The predatory lending stuff. And
the brokers themselves that are worried more about their commissions than they are the security of the, at the end, institution that makes the mortgage, you know. Are you tracking with all that?
Mr. Hansen.
You're a South St. Paul guy. I know you can keep up there.
What I would say is I'm not in the real estate area. My investigators and I have gotten into the real estate area because it involves insurance as well. But I believe our real estate team and appraiser investigators have actually revoked a significant number of appraiser licenses. There has been one, to my knowledge, that was criminally prosecuted out of the Parish Marketing and Development case, an appraiser. As to mortgage brokers, while a large number of them went out of business or dropped their licenses after a recent statutory change, and I think that was probably a good thing, if you have a large number of licensees chasing a certain volume of business, after a while, one way to get some business is to start doing things that would be illegal or at least ethically challenged.
I think you got it.
Yeah, I think. Thank you very much. It helps.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say thank you, too, for giving us this opportunity right at the beginning of session to have this kind of information available and start this conversation, because just for the other committee members who may not be aware, I'm the legislative appointee to the Financial Crimes Task Force Oversight Board. And so during the interim, I've had a number of meetings about this subject generally. And really have some issues and concerns, but I'm not quite sure if I have a good handle on the best direction to go to deal with this as a state. I think we've all heard, if I'm correct, that Minnesota and the number of mortgage foreclosures, I think, is like fifth on by number. And if you put that on a per capita perspective, I'm not actually sure where we fall, but I would assume quite a bit higher even, if not right at the top, considering that I think a couple of the states ahead of us were like California, Florida. So I'm not sure if anyone knows that statistic, but it doesn't seem to be a very good one for our state. And then specifically in my hometown, somewhat less than a year ago, but more than 6 months ago, this exact scenario that was described by Mr. Hansen in this chart seemed to be what was reported in our local newspaper. I want to be careful not to say more than that because, you know, there hasn't been a prosecution yet. But it all came out in the paper, and then nothing's really happened since then. And just kind of as a backdrop to that, the article in the paper said that our assessor's office had been reporting this to Commerce for a couple of years, a pattern of what appeared to be concerning activity with the assessed prices of homes, and it involved a mortgage broker and an appraiser and a real estate agent, as you said, and at least in terms of what was reported in the paper. And then one more thing I'd put into the mix, and that's the fact that last session, with our budget constraints we already had, the Financial Crimes Task Force has had its budget cut in half. with the hope that there would be some reorganization or, you know, some kind of a new plan coming forward. It seems as though with the budget constraints we have now, you know, it's really difficult to find a way to put more resources into what looks to be a growing area of crime, growing sophistication, you know. So I guess I'm just wondering, I know there have been kind of a, this is a real broad question, but if we're looking for a way with limited resources to try to consolidate, to try to streamline, to try to make more effective our approach to financial crimes, where there does seem to be a problem in, and I could give you kind of a list, not just the things within commerce, but in other bits and pieces of how we're dealing with financial crimes within other departments as well. And one of the issues I've heard identified as a problem in approaching this this area of crime is kind of a difficulty in communication between departments and sometimes just within our resources as far as the infrastructure we would need to do a better job communicating. Do you have any suggestions or reactions to what direction the state might go to address this problem to do a better job?
Commissioner, or
yes, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think you're correct, and that's one of the things that we're pretty pleased actually to be here today to be able to address. I think that we have really begun to put together a solid investigatory area in terms of finance, financial instruments, and in real estate. Many of these investigations. And on the real estate area, I could tell you numerous stories of other incidences. We just took some samples. But it's taken us about 2 years to develop the expertise. And every day we're learning. I would have thought, in fact, I went to one of our investigators early this week, and I said, is there any indication that mortgage crime, being somebody in the real estate business for 30 years, it would seem to me that this type of crime would be declining in as much as it would be hard to get somebody to buy these loans without doing underwriting on them. And that was a big problem, that industry bought millions of loans with no underwriting whatsoever. And one of the reasons I'm a little off track, but to answer another question you brought up, the number of foreclosures in our state is high. I can tell you as a mortgage banker here for 11 years that, and to some degree this continues, but for 11 years, we were honored to be here and headquartered in Minnesota because they had the lowest foreclosure and delinquency rates in the United States. So we had an invitation because there was little oversight and underwriting. Loans here with no underwriting got sold into the secondary market without any question because historically they were so good. And it brought people into our market. But specifically on your question relative to the mortgage, I do think that we have now between Bonnie's team, Paul's team, and we're taking these seriously as criminal activity. In the Parrish case, it took us months to put – well, first of all, twice – and this may be a negative reflection on our department, but I'll be honest with you. Edina Realty called and said, you know, down here in this one subdivision, their houses are selling for more than we think they're worth, and we're getting listings that we can't get what they're – we can't get it up to those values. What's wrong? Well, we'd get a foul, and we would go through the foul. The foul justified everything appeared to be right. We got another call. Edina Realty said, this house, another one's been sold for a higher price than we think, but it's not even occupied. Neither is the other one we called you about. We get the foul. We look at all the documentation. The licensed appraiser has the appraiser in there. You got a realtor. You have the notary, everything, the closing, the title insurance, the mortgage insurance, all in place, all adequately documented. we get a third call. So then we send people out. What? There's got to be something going on here. We start pulling files. And sure enough, we get some other agencies involved. I'll tell you another side, but these are very complicated cases. The FBI, because there are so many criminals involved in the case, so many people, renters, they're paying half rent, and people, the real victims are some of those that paid an honest price to get in there and have all these vacant houses around them. But the FBI helped in it, and other agencies don't have the expertise that our agency does. So they called and they said, look, we'll go after the appraiser for you, but we need for you to develop the questions. So we give him a bunch of questions. Well, the guy leaves the state, goes to Oklahoma. They track him down 3 months later and say, okay, we got the questions, but I'm an experienced examiner. I think I can get a confession, but I need about 10 more questions. And we're adjourned for lunch. So the team gets together, give him about a dozen more questions. He calls back at 3 o'clock. He says, I got him. He's confessed to over appraising about 30 houses. He's been sentenced to 18 months. The builder got 13 years. The builder's son got 8 years, and his wife got 3 years. The appraiser got 18 months. The other appraiser, we got a year, and we're still after, I forgot who, but there's still two more to be prosecuted in that single case. But that's the complexity and the time frame of getting all that done is 2.5 years.
Commissioner, was that a case where there was no real buyer? They were just securing mortgages?
Well, they had false buyers.
Mm-hmm.
They would hire a buyer, they would get a cut out. The average was about $100,000 more than the value.
In that particular case, some of the straw buyers were relatives, other family members of the parishes. And they straw buyers, while some people will say, well, they're kind of victims, they sometimes come to us as, in fact, in one case, a straw buyer actually brought a case to us saying, look, I'm getting into foreclosure here, and they promised me all these things. And you look at it, and, well, you got paid for this, that the money's running dry now to make the payments, but you also got paid to do this transaction and to sign these documents fraudulently. Now, as they're a witness, you're talking to them, and you don't let on that you know that they're actually one of the respondents or defendants. Sure. But, you know, and some people would class them as victims because now their credit is ruined and whatever. But they, in most cases, straw buyers got considerable sums of money for these transactions. They can run anywhere from $5,000 to, I've seen them as high as $30,000 per transaction. Excuse me.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that detailed explanation because it really gives a kind of a face to what we're talking about here. And I think as long as our chair allows, that is a good introduction to exactly what I was talking about. Because what I'm asking, I guess, is, for example, in the case in Bemidji, the article in the newspaper talked about the fact that there had been a couple of years worth of that kind of questioning by our county assessor to Commerce before it got to the point where enough of a pattern was recognized or acknowledged, or for whatever reason, you know, before it kind of went to the next level. And from what I understand about a lot of organized criminals, they're not necessarily organizing their criminal activities along the lines of how we divide our departments within the state in terms of areas of responsibility. And so someone who's doing that kind of very organized criminal mortgage fraud activity might also be doing some other kinds of financial crime activity that falls within different departments. And so how the best way to attack that overall problem, which, as you said, is very complicated and requires people with expertise and also communications. so that the first time you get that kind of a report, like you described from Edina Realty, there's a way to run that through some type of law enforcement mechanism to see whether these are people who have been committing other kinds of financial crimes. I guess that was a bit kind of what my question was driving at, and I think your example gave a good concrete illustration of the question I'm asking, or yes, how we might approach that.
Madam
Commissioner.
I didn't answer that very well. We do appreciate that capability, and George's office, as well as the rest of the department, is putting in a case management system and a system that would help identify. George, do you have any? We are looking at every opportunity to cross-reference as much of this as possible.
Mr. Hanson.
Senator Olson, what I'd say is Bonnie is just two doors down from me. I'm in her office probably several times a day now. Her investigators are right next to my investigators. They're constantly talking about different cases. Now, do we have a capacity problem? You mentioned budget constraints. Yeah, we've got a capacity problem. But I do know from my experiences with other regulators around the country, Minnesota is fairly unique. We've got a lot of expertise in the financial area for a variety of different types of products and industries under one roof. And in my discussions with other regulators around the country, what they're able to do, I still have other regulatory counterparts of mine elsewhere in the country that aren't even grasping some of the issues we've actually taken action against people on in this state. So I think we're doing the best we can with the resources we have. Could there be more done? Yes, but that's somewhat up to the commissioner and you folks.
And I appreciate just knowing. Certainly I knew the areas you regulate in the Department of Commerce. At least I think I know maybe most of them. But the fact that it is under one roof, that you have the securities, the financial institutions, insurance, real estate, all of those entities regulated in one department is apparently a really big deal, because these things, as you say, Senator Olson, do involve crimes that overlap areas. Now, I don't know what other, I mean, there's all kinds of financial crimes. I mean, even collection agencies. That whole business is interesting to me as well. So I think that we could all agree we probably need to have more. But can we afford to do it? I mean, we can't. We're doing more now than we used to, and I assume we'll be, moving forward. Senator Vandeveer, did you want to say something?
Well, I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, is there a specific proposal yet, or is this just preliminary?
Senator Vandeveer, this is to get information about what's going on with investigations of fraud and how the department's handling it, and it's informational. I mean, I for one think it's pretty interesting.
So So the strike force is just that one thought.
Pardon me?
The strike force in this letter
is that Attorney General's letter?
Yes, is just one proposal or.
That's actually what, an 11 or 12 year old letter, and may, Mr. Johnson.
Oh, it is a little.
It's written to Bob
that,
Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, and so.
Never mind.
Sorry, but I think Mr. Johnson can kind of maybe touch on that. But are there any other questions? I really appreciate the information. It was very interesting.
Thank you,
Madam. It's getting more interesting every year.
Well, it sure is from our perspective, yeah. And we're getting better at it. We're getting more sophisticated, and we're getting better at it. I'll admit that. Even after we started the fraud unit, it took about 2 years, frankly, to get it well organized, everybody working together. They hadn't been a team before. We hired some people that didn't have white-collar experience before. We put some analysts in there. But now we have the capability of doing the computer forensics and better training, better teamwork. So we feel a lot better about it than we have. I have two quick closing.
Yes.
One, I just wanted to say that any of you are welcome to come over. This past year, we built out a new facility for the fraud unit. Anybody that's interested in looking at it, we're pretty proud of it. We'd like to invite you to see it. Secondly, Fox News Channel 9
On Sunday evening, I alerted you falsely a week ago.
Okay,
that they
it's
were
coming. It hasn't happened yet.
Tomorrow they're going to start promotions on it, and okay. Sunday evening they will have the story that I think outlines pretty well. It's it shows our department serving some warrants and subpoenas and going into numerous locations with several counties' cooperation, several other agencies' cooperation. It's a major case, and it'd be a good way for the public to get a better idea of what we do. And that, in turn, like any other agency, we get better leads all the time as well. So we're doing more of this, and your cooperation has been very much appreciated in the department. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Commissioner, thank you. Mr. Hansen, Mr. Carrillis, thank you very much. Mr. Johnson. Welcome to our first meeting.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Madam Chair, if I could ask the committee members, there's just the one handout, kind of the thick one, if you could take that and have that in front of you, and then maybe the two-page letter that you had referenced, Madam Chair, from former Attorney General Hubert Humphrey. And I'm Bob Johnson with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, Madam Chair, and I greatly appreciate this. I would start and put two questions on the table for the Congress committee members. First is this issue of insurance fraud worth your time, the legislature's, our time to debate and look at what's happening and what are things we can do? And I think the letter from the Attorney General Humphrey, I think, answers that question. Is it worth the time? This letter, as you stated, the time was in 1997, and as part of a national insurance fraud fighting group that the Attorney General served on for his term at office, the estimate of $1,000 per year in cost to every family, if you just inflation and just adjust that, that puts it to $1,300 or $1,400 today, at least that. Few issues, Madam Chair, will come before this legislature that affects consumers of a magnitude of, if it's $1,200 a year per family in costs, the average homeowner's premium in this state per year is about $1,100. So that's an entire year of a homeowner's insurance premium. So it's a significant issue. The literature proves that it's been consistent. After Attorney General Humphrey left, Attorney General Mike Hatch continued as a named board member of this organization, I believe, for the full duration of his terms in office. And obviously they rotate the boards of that, but that's a more recent creation, the CAIF. But there are other groups like that represent partnerships of public and private and consumer and academic. I think if you looked at the current board of the CIF, you would find a very broad array of, again, academics, prosecutors, the Consumer Federation of America, who have agreed and serve on a board that the issue of insurance fraud in all of its areas and the impact on consumers is worth a national fight, and it's worth a coordinated effort on a state-by-state level. I think on the Attorney General Humphrey letter and Senator Vandiver, if you pull that up, And Madam Chair, I'm only going to just talk about the first seven pages of this, so this will not be that long. I'm just going to walk through that. And then the rest of it, I just, for my own purposes, thought it would be helpful to put in one place actual copies of the laws that were passed, and in some cases the session laws, because there are paragraphs that were passed, the session laws, that are not codified law but represented laws passed by the legislature to specifically deal with insurance fraud, but they didn't work their way into the statutes. And I'll reference that right up front, because that's in the context of Attorney General Humphrey's letter. So if you pick that letter up and then turn to page 35 of the book, and the thicker one. What that letter represented was Attorney General Humphrey, after the legislature in the 2006 session passed, and that's the language that you have in front of you, the Section 38, the insurance fraud revolving account, which was language drafted by Attorney General Humphrey, brought to the legislature in conjunction with the insurance industry, which I learned for the first time then that you actually can donate money to the state of Minnesota for public purposes And he did ask, and we did respond. So I think that letter is Attorney General Humphrey documenting the problem, talking about this insurance fraud strike force, which the legislature had authorized in this 1996 session. And frankly, we were at that year, we responded as an industry and provided monies to the Attorney General's office that were used to hire law enforcement personnel, licensed police officers, to do criminal investigatory matters. And it was under the direction of Assistant Attorney General David Orbach, who headed that up during those years. And that office pulled together, and I don't have the file with me, but we could get the file of cases that were worked up, presented, and then prosecuted. One of the focuses, frankly, was on smaller insurance arson fraud, fires, which is a crime, of course, but smaller arson fires often don't get prosecuted because there's guidelines on what cases prosecutors' offices can take up. So the Attorney General's office actually focused on some cases in areas that were not, that didn't hit the thresholds of a Hennepin County prosecutor and some other offices. So I think there is an example of Senator Vandeveer of a partnership that took place between the Attorney General's office and the industry and the legislature agreeing to pass a law. We responded, and it produced results. Fraud cases were prosecuted coming out of that. There have been other examples that I don't have in the literature here about cooperative partnerships between the private sector and the public sector. We meet regularly with the county attorneys, and the county attorneys are the frontline prosecutors, chargers, if you will, of the crime of insurance fraud. And we've worked with that office to help fund the development of insurance and arson prosecutors' manual, in many cases, to get the crimes prosecuted. The prosecutors needed to be trained about the working up of the files and what goes into it. And frankly, the arson prosecutor's manual was recently updated, and we were able to assist. And this is a pretty straightforward deal. If we can raise money, it's 100% managed within the prosecutor's offices. They find prosecutors that will take the time. They need the resources to pay for the development of it. So it's 100% done and controlled within the prosecutor's purview. But we think that that is an assist to the public policy goals here of fighting insurance fraud. So at least on the question of is insurance fraud worth the fight, we're confident it is. It needs to continue to be. It is not diminishing. In fact, it's likely growing in areas in today's economics in terms of arson and what we're seeing with just a number of areas. And the George Carillis and Paul Hansen, Commissioner Wilson, kind of covered that, and we're delighted that we now have the resources on board this state in a state agency with focused resources, with law enforcement personnel investigating insurance fraud in all of its aspects. So in terms of I think the first question, hopefully the answer is yes. The second question, which you might find instructive, at least just for a little bit, is all right, if it's worth the fight, what have we done as a state? Has Minnesota done anything in insurance fraud? And that's really the purpose of what you have in front of you. And if, Madam Chair, if the committee members just pull this up, I'll just walk through this relatively quickly, and I would be happy to kind of stop if anyone would like me to talk about any one of these. Here's a comment I'd make up front that I think is worthwhile. I think it's without exception, every one of these bills that was passed that reaches back some 30 years was bipartisan. There's leadership in all caucuses, in both the House and Senate, with the governor's support, whoever the governor was, and with strong public-private partnerships, without exception. Prosecutors involved, the Attorney General's office, the insurance industry. Again, it's those. Every one of these laws represent, in my opinion, a coming together up at this institution of the public policymakers agreeing it's worth the fight. In many cases, these were driven by extreme situations that happened, you know, shortly before a legislative session. Prominent cases, front page newspaper, and I could get into that, Madam Chair, if committee members would be interested there, but that's absolutely what's happened in a number of cases. Prominent criminal cases prompted the legislature to ask the question, okay, this is not right. This is costing consumers a lot of money. Is there anything we can do to stop this, to combat it, to prevent it? So having said that, I'll just quickly walk through it and just to give you a flavor, but this, and I don't know if this is a complete recitation of the laws, but I think it's pretty complete over the last 30 years. And that really represents the time frame where insurance fraud specific statutes have been enacted. If you go, you dial back before that, insurance fraud didn't get the kind of recognition, the kind of attention. It just didn't. It was processed under under theft statutes, and it didn't get the kind of focused attention that we see it receiving today. But page 2 of the outline, and I just repeat it here for the committee members, this is the current statute that defines the crime of insurance fraud. The key thing here is just in the second paragraph. And at the essence of insurance fraud is this language, statements or representations that contain a false representation as to any material fact. You will find that at the core, that's the core definition of what insurance fraud is. This law and these various paragraphs cover the fraud. If it's a person claiming benefits, an individual consumer, if it's fraud in terms of anybody in the insurance transaction, agents, companies, all of the facets or everybody involved in the transaction are covered under these various paragraphs of 609.611. I think the department has just recited good examples on page 3, Madam Chair, about the types of insurance fraud. And I've already covered the Attorney General, so if you want to turn to page 4, and then I'll just kind of walk through these and just highlight, and just to give you a flavor, really back in the late 70s, that Chapter 226 in 1979 represented the legislature's first time, and then the legislature acted 3 subsequent times to pass a very similar law to this. Arson mandatory reporting. At the core of these laws is the following. Insurance companies have within their files in working on claims or issues information that's relevant to the crime of insurance fraud. These laws require us as companies to report that information to authorized individuals. George Carlos is an authorized individual under the state statutes. Attorney generals, the county prosecutors, law enforcement, BCA, those are all authorized individuals. And we're required to report that information to those entities. And then those are the essence and the materials that they need to proceed to go forward with criminal investigation of these crimes. So the legislature back in 79 started that process. And again, you'll see through this outline 3 subsequent times where the legislature passed separate laws in the workers' compensation area, in the auto theft area, and then a general mandatory reporting law that covers all lines of insurance. So it's found in 4 places in the current Minnesota statutes. 1983 was a passage of a specific tool under our standard fire policy in Minnesota. It's called an examination under oath. Minnesota law section in it that actually requires the language that is in all the contracts everyone in this room buys under their homeowner's policy, the standard fire policy language. And this is a tool to help combat arson and fraud under the policies in terms of the ability to require individuals filing claims to submit to an examination under oath. It's found in the state laws of all 50 states, and so it's a common feature. We happened to pass ours in 1983. 1987, Madam Chair, then here's a repeat in the auto theft reporting immunity. You'll see these laws, they all have the identical structure, definitional boxes, the authorized individual, so it repeats itself. Then in that year, the 1997, was the enhanced criminal penalties for auto theft. So auto theft was an issue that was getting some more prominent attention. The legislature started acting and then acted to combat it on a number of instances. As I walk through this, you'll see those. In 1990, the legislature passed a specific law that deals with public insurance adjusters. They're licensed individuals who consumers can hire to kind of help them process claims. And there were some issues in those years preceding that. So the legislature acted to have specific prohibitions on how that individuals can and cannot conduct themselves in the marketplace. In 1992, on page 5 of the outline, was a year where there was one of those years where this institution had an enormous, a big public policy debate on the workers' compensation system. 1992, as I indicate, was one of the major, most significant work comp reform bills in the last 25 years in Minnesota. 1995 was the second one, but the 92 one focused on medical cost containment. In that law were these specific provisions that deal with fraud. Prior to that year, there actually wasn't a separate delineated crime known as workers' compensation fraud that was created. So I put the two references there. The legislature also expanded the criminal definition of fraud to include medical provider fraud in the context of the workers' compensation system. And then in that year, the legislature actually passed for the first time. It was a specific unit within an agency to focus on the fight against fraud. So Labor and Industry had the first formally organized fraud unit. It was fewer resources, fewer people, very similar to George Carillis in the fraud unit at the Commerce Department. And you'll see that repeat as we walk through this. Ultimately, they were all consolidated into what's now in the Commerce Department. In 1994 was a significant major insurance fraud reform bill. And again, on all these, Madam Chair, these were bipartisan. They were collaborative. They involved public and private leadership, both the House and the Senate. They just supported broad support. There might have been some no votes, but I don't think there were many on many of these bills through all of these years. In 1994, and these are all still current provisions, all insurers were required to adopt an actual anti-fraud plan, so an individual corporate game plan to fight the crime of insurance fraud. And so this anti-fraud plan was a mandate in that year. The second one, and these were all in Chapter 574, was the requirement that fraud warnings be put on claim forms. So if you file a claim today, you'll see that printed on the bottom of claim forms. This was the year, and that was the law that mandated that, and so it's uniform and it's found on all forms in Minnesota. And then that was the year that the legislature adopted, again here, a broad all-lines mandatory reporting law in terms of, these statutes define what relevant information is. They get very specific, and so they delineate the information that's in the hands of insurers that investigators, prosecutors, law enforcement needs to have to work on these cases and on the files. 1995, the bottom of page 5 was the last one. There was a specific workers' compensation law passed about mandatory reporting of information. Then in 1996, as I referenced, one of the provisions in that year, Madam Chair, that this was one of the very significant years in terms of fraud bills that were passed by the legislature. And as I started up front, this was a year that for the first time Minnesota actually defined, and as it sits today in Minnesota law, the crime of insurance fraud was established. And these were, we worked with the prosecutors. Again, this was language that was put together by Attorney General, the county attorneys, those entities that have the responsibility for charging these crimes. And so the crime of insurance fraud was established, that Attorney General revolving account that I referenced already. And in 1996, this was the year that Minnesota created this auto theft prevention program. Didn't exist. And for instance, that the chief author, I'll just give one example. Senator Phil Rivness was the chief author in the Senate of the auto theft program. Representative Mary Murphy was the chief author on the House side. So again, very strong bipartisan support, the private sector, the public sector, we all work together. And this is a law that put in place the $1 per year that we all pay our auto policies today, that all the whole dollar doesn't go to now, the fight against auto theft, because a few years later, and I think I referenced it in here, the legislature passed a law, an amendment to this law, that permanently moves 50 cents out of each dollar into the general revenue. So there's an example of Senator Olson of Resources that, I don't have the data here, but I served on the initial board of the Auto Theft Prevention Program. So I was appointed as one of the members in the first 3 years. And the first year, 3 years of the program, when all of the resources were designated, and this program is set up to give grants to police departments and to prosecutors. That's the essence of where the dollars go. Overtime for law enforcement to do bait car undercover efforts to combat auto theft. In the first 3 years after the program was passed, auto thefts in Minnesota decreased, and I think it's 28%, but I have the number. It was a significant impact. Because auto theft, the numbers were moving up, and they were moving up fairly significantly. So again, I think the legislature recognized it, responded to it, and it's a program that has now, all of this is consolidated down again, but it was started in 1996. In 1997, was the first of two. Attorney General Humphrey actually had convened arson's task forces that had a pretty broad representation of public, private. His office ran the meetings, ran the task forces. That chapter 239 represented, and if you pull it up on the session laws, you'll see the caption, Attorney General Arson Task Force. So the legislature enacted the recommendations of that Attorney General Task Force, and this Arson Strike Force was one of them. And there are other provisions in there. I didn't list them all, but criminal code upgrades, enhancements, I think that's the right description to those. Then in 2001, Madam Chair, as the Financial Crimes Task Force that Senator Olson has already referenced was created that year. And the Arson Strike Force was reauthorized that year. And then on page 7 was in 2002, actually, as Commissioner Wilson described, that was the year that the fraud division was created. It was funded 2 years later. So there wasn't any money put in it in 2002. But so when that was created, then the auto theft program and the work comp programs, all those were moved and consolidated back into one unit, which we supported and felt is just prudent to have it in one place. And that also was the year, if you look under the 2002, we reference the criminal code provision on runners and cappers. That actually was a freestanding bill that Attorney General Hatch had drafted. It was chief authored by Senator Foley. It was ultimately rolled into, Madam Chair, the bill that you were the chief author of that had the fraud unit in it. And so that was language that Attorney General Hatch had drafted. And that was one of those examples of prominent criminal prosecutions prior to the start of that session for medical insurance fraud in the no-fault auto area that was on the front page of the Pioneer Press for 3 straight days, very prominent, that frankly helped precipitate, I think, the environment up at the Capitol that caused these laws to be passed. And then lastly, Madam Chair, the funding for the fraud unit was passed in 2004, and then the rest is history, as they say. So, Madam Chair, that's the overview of the fraud laws. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that or any other issues that committee members have.
Mr. Johnson, this is very helpful. It's interesting to see the language that relates to the listing on pages 1 through 7. I appreciate it. Work in putting that together. Do the members have any questions or comments?
I do.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry to be a microphone hog or whatever.
Senator Olson, you have every right. That this is what we do in committees. And
well, thank you. You know, and the reason I have a lot to say about this or concern about this, of course, is because, you know, as I've said before to other committee members, this is something before coming to the legislature that I spent a lot of time on in my previous profession. And this is all very, I think, helpful, accurate, factual information in terms of delineating the laws. But there's sort of a spin on it or that would attempt to kind of convey the impression that insurance fraud is a very big problem in this state. And I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I'm not convinced it's true simply because we take a number, a dollar number, which I guess we weren't told what it was from many years ago, and then automatically assume that there's inflation on that number every year since until we come up with a much larger number. So I'd certainly want to see those facts, and that would kind of assume that none of these things that were done to combat this have had any impact or been successful. So I would challenge that and want to know that there's some kind of an up-to-date study that would say that insurance fraud is a big problem. Also, you know, if the Department of Commerce is looking at 12 individual chiropractors, well, I certainly wouldn't defend those actions. Obviously, none of us would. You know, how many chiropractors are there in the state? And do we need to be careful when we pass these laws and as we look at these things that consumer interests are also being protected? Because there's often, we were just talking about this actually with someone in the Attorney General's office yesterday. Minnesota is one of the few states that does not have an organization or an entity that separately represents consumer interests when we're looking at issues like this.
And when you have a bad actor or two or a big case that gets in the headlines, as Mr. Johnson said, you know, that brings those issues to our attention. But just like in life in general, we have to be careful that we don't take one because of one bad actor or one situation that we put something in place that has ramifications for everyone that would treat them all as somehow they're criminals or paint them all with that brush. And the reason I say that, Madam Chair, was Mr. Johnson pointed out and specifically referenced some language that's in law today that I believe gets often used exactly that way by the insurance industry. And the language he quoted was false representation as to any material fact. Very often that becomes a threat to a consumer as a means to deny a claim. I've seen this happen, and I know that there are lawyers around the state who could testify that this has happened to their clients, where, for example, someone wants to make a claim and they are threatened with the fact that, well, gee, you forgot to include this aspect of your medical history when you told us that, you know, that we asked you to fill out these forms, and now if you want us to pay this bill for you, we may report you for criminal prosecution because you didn't include this material fact in filling out your claim. The same thing can happen in automobile insurance. And so these things, we have to be careful because we have to recognize that initially what we started with is a contract between the insurance industry and the insured. And when there's a violation of that contract, we have done a lot to criminalize that violation from the standpoint of what the insured does. If the insured does something that would normally be considered a civil matter or a fraudulent matter, we've made a special crime out of that kind of to help the insurance industry prevent in its contracts with insureds. We certainly don't have something that goes the other way, where the insured and the insurance company is held criminally responsible if it takes the same type of action against its insured in denying claims. In other words, if there's no material basis for the denial of claim, there's no corresponding penalty for the insurance industry. So I only throw that out there to say that we have to be careful there's a balance. And as we look at these things, we're not unfairly penalizing consumers as a whole because of the acts of a few bad actors, which certainly are not defensible.
Well, Senator Olson, I don't know if I can comment on each of the things you said. I think the key word in the insurance fraud definition is material fact. It seems to me if a victim forgets to mention that they had already lost the use of their arm in some other accident and now they're claiming that their arm was injured in an accident, that would be a material misrepresentation, that kind of thing. I mean, material means it pertains to or it's important to the facts or the situation that, you know, they're claiming. I don't think that we're trying to decide here with this hearing whether or not insurance companies treat their insureds unfairly or not. We had quite a bit conversation about this in the last 2 years over the bad faith legislation, and we talked about that. And so there is certainly some kind of consequence when insurance companies don't honor, you know, the contract. But I think I'm surprised, frankly, Mr. Johnson, when you said that it might be $1,300 or $1,400 or about whatever in that range that the cost is to Minnesota families every year. I'm surprised it's that low, frankly, because values of homes are, you know, much higher today than they were in 1997 when Attorney General Humphrey wrote that. And if there's arson, every time there is this fraud, we all pay. I understand you're thinking of the one person who's harmed, and I know we need to care about that person. But I'm thinking of in having this hearing and in my concern about fraud is that all of us pay when there's fraud in the system, and people are allowed to. You know, I don't think we can afford to let them get away with that. I'm surprised it's not more than $1,000, given that that's what it was then, and also then with the testimony of the gentleman from
the Department of Commerce talking about how the cases are growing in number rather than, you know, declining, and they're seeing more evidence of fraud. And some of it, and it's not all insurance fraud, if you will, that they describe for us, but nevertheless, we are all paying for that. We are paying when we go and purchase something in a store, you know, a department store, whether it's Walmart or Macy's or wherever. We're paying for the theft. We're paying for people who didn't pay their bills. We're paying all of us as consumers are paying, and I'm concerned about that. So I'm not trying to not talk about where insurance companies may have problems or issues that we should be concerned about, but that this was about the kinds of fraud. And actually, we did hear about fraud perhaps where inappropriate products were sold to people. If you fraud, you know, we have the law on suitability. We have that requirement. And I think it's clear that some, you know, that's been violated in cases, and they've been prominently displayed in the last couple of years. And I think we still have concerns in that area, but, you know, the department is looking at those as well, and they're hearing about those. So, Senator Olson, I didn't mean to put down what you're saying. It just, that wasn't really the focus of what I wanted to talk about. But we can, you know.
Well, and Madam Chair, and I guess that was the reason I brought it up, is because I think the focus has been here from the insurance industry standpoint, who Mr. Johnson represents. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to just point out, not that those aren't valid concerns, but I happen to believe that this specific language of false representation as to any material fact has been really grossly misused by some of the insurance companies toward very unsophisticated consumers, because it can be a very heavy-handed weapon. And, you know, in fact, I'd be happy to even ask some of my colleagues to provide some examples that I could show you of what
I'd be glad to see where that was used as a threat or an intimidation factor.
Right. And so I guess that's all I'm saying, is just that, you know, we need to be careful that there's some balance, because, you know, I don't know whether, and I would be concerned, too, about any kind of obvious, any kind of criminal activity, you know, and certainly any kind of organized, really gross examples like we've heard of today. But I'm also concerned that we don't provide the insurance industry with any kind of a weapon to unfairly deny claims, because they certainly have a lot more sophistication and monetary assets at their disposal than do individual insureds in most cases. And, you know, it's a very profitable industry, so...
And that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that that's because we have good state regulation, and we want to be sure we keep that. By the way, as Commissioner, I'm hoping that we will have some kind of a hearing on the optional federal charter. It'll be also informational, and I want the committee to think about that. It won't necessarily have a bill attached. It will probably have a resolution attached to our congressional delegation about whether or not insurance should be regulated at the federal level. They did such a good job with financial institutions. They now want to regulate the insurance industry. And the industry, the insurance industry, is not all in agreement about this either. But I think we, as legislators, and the department as regulators, want, you know, would like to have our say. So we're going to be doing that in the near future, actually. We'll be talking about that. But, Senator Olson, I think that I'm happy to, you know, to hear from you about. I mean, if you want to look at that language in that in 609 there, and I don't see anything on its face that presents itself that I'm concerned about it. But that doesn't mean it hasn't been, as you're suggesting, it's been abused or used against people. You know, I'm happy to look at that. But this wasn't to be the all encompassing information on insurance. We know it's an important aspect of our financial security,
And we pay it, and we pay a lot of money for insurance, and we hope we never have to use it. And when we need it, we are sure glad we have it, and we want it to work. And the bad faith legislation, I think, certainly had to go in the direction that you would like to see, where an insurance company does not act in good faith toward their insured. You know, that seems to be a pretty strong disincentive as far as I was concerned, you know, what we passed. So, but maybe you and I can have the conversation after.
Maybe.
Okay. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't disagree that insurance companies might need a little oversight on occasion, Senator Olson. But with that, I do want to take just a moment off subject and thank the Commerce Department and recommend to you that if you do have a disaster of some sort, such as we had the Hugo tornado, I can tell you they were there answering questions and helping constituents right from the very beginning, and I think performed admirably. And I, along with the people I represent, were very appreciative of their help. So Commissioner Wilson and Mr. Walsh, thank you very much for your help in the Hugo tornado.
So, members, we will be meeting then again a week from today. We'll be in room 15 at our regular time. Well, no, we won't be at our regular time. Forgive me. It's the State of the State address. That'll be held, though, on campus, if you will. Not in this room, unfortunately. In the House of Representatives chamber. So that's at noon, I think. And we're either going to meet at 1:15 or after the State of the State, whichever is later. I think about, but does that make some sense? So if 1:15 is later than the State of the State, that's fine. You can get something to eat or whatever. No eating in the House chamber. So with that, members, thank everybody for coming and being here. And meeting's adjourned.